Good morning. My name is Tom Merrigan, registration number 7874, appearing on behalf of the City of Golden. The Supreme Court in the Hirschfeld case said a purchase of an item of tangible personal property is a purchase for resale and therefore not a purchase at retail if the primary purpose of the transaction is the acquisition of the item for resale in an unaltered condition and basically unused by the purchaser. So this case turns on the answer to one question. That question is, why does Coors buy, use, and store coils of aluminum at the end plant? And the answer is because they need to use it to make cans. That's the business that they're in.
Mr. Merrigan, I'll jump right in here. You make the assumption, I guess you make the argument directly, there can only be one primary purpose.
Yes.
It seems to me, and the Coors folks here argue, there are two purposes at the beginning. They knew they were going to have this skeleton when they started. And so their purpose at the beginning, we're going to use what we can to make the canned ends and the tabs and whatever else we're going to sell for scrap. And they knew that from minute one.
Yes.
And so why aren't both of those primary purposes?
Because there is no case that holds that you can have more than one primary purpose. And the discussion in Hirschfeld makes that clear, we believe. And the fact, it's true, it's like they have a crystal ball. They know exactly what's going to happen to this aluminum when they buy it, and there is nothing changes. 80% of it is going to go into cans. Approximately 20% of it is going to be recycled. But the fact that they are able to recycle it is nothing more than a good business decision. It is not, if they could do this without recycling, without scrap, they would. Because, as you know from our brief, they lose 10% value on the recycling operation. It affects their bottom line adversely. So if there was a way to make cans without having any waste, they would do it. But the technology isn't there, and they need a flat surface with straight edges to run through the manufacturing machines that stamp out the ends and the tabs.
Pardon me, Mr. Merrigan, if I may.
Yes.
You rely on Hirschfeld, but in Hirschfeld, you basically don't have anything going out the door at the back end. You have the stuff gets incorporated into the product for the client, and that's where it goes.
Right.
Here, let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume that instead of creating the briquettes that they create with the smushing process, what if they just simply rolled up the skeletons and sold them?
You know,
would that be different for you?
I don't think so, because the scrap aluminum is not a finished product. The fact that they happen to put it into a brick doesn't matter. If they put it into a ball, or if they just collected it and put it into a bin, it would still be scrap aluminum. It is not a product, it is a commodity. It is sold by the pound. So it is different from, and legally treated different by virtue of the processing clause, from the material that's incorporated into the cans.
Well, okay, because of the virtue of the different treatment, haven't you just made Coors' argument? Because if it is a commodity, and thus they bring it in understanding that it is a commodity and that they're going to resell it as a commodity, why isn't that wholesale?
Because that's not the primary purpose, and you can only have one primary purpose. They don't buy aluminum to recycle it. They would, like I said earlier, they would prefer not to recycle it.
But status is that they are not in that situation, so that's not the facts in front of us. The facts in front of us are they know that they're going to recycle it.
Right, but there is no case in where the Supreme Court has not said that you can have two primary purposes when you buy something.
Well, how do you deal with Conoco then? And I recognize it's factually somewhat distinct, but at least Conoco would support, you know, their crude oil is purchased, and that's exempt. But then you generate, you know, waste gas or whatever else. Oh, we can treat the waste gas differently. Essentially, you've got two ends of the same transaction, and you're treating the two pieces differently. The crude oil we're going to treat as exempt, and the waste gas we're treating as taxable, as because it's used. Well, I mean, I recognize it's factually distinct, but doesn't that support an argument that you can look at the two pieces of the transaction differently? Because under your view, if the, all you look at is the primary purpose, it was all exempt, and you never get to because the waste gas came from the crude oil.
Well,
you would never get to tax it.
In the Conoco and IBM cases, the transactions started out as wholesale transactions. Okay? They intended their purpose in buying the material that they bought was to resell. Okay. In this case, the transaction starts out as a retail transaction. I am aware of no factual scenario where you can go that direction. You can go from wholesale to retail because the purchaser makes a decision to use the material themselves, and that changed the tax treatment. Once you say, hey, I want to use this gas to heat my building, or I want to use this computer to keep track of how many other computers I'm selling, then that changes what was a wholesale transaction into a retail transaction.
Well, let me make sure I understand you, your argument here, Mr. Merrigan. Reading from Conoco, subsequent use or consumption of property may trigger the use tax based on a retroactive recognition that a previous sale earlier thought to be wholesale was actually retail.
Right.
Because so didn't you just say otherwise, or did I miss it?
I said that you can convert something that was wholesale into retail by deciding to use it yourself. And once you use and consume it yourself, it has become a retail transaction and taxes owed. One of the big issues in Conoco was how and when do we value this use gas, this waste gas? And so the timing became important for the valuation purpose. I don't believe that case has any bearing on the Hirschfeld analysis whatsoever.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? I want to go back to something you said at the very inception of your oral argument. I may have misunderstood the import of what you're saying. Are you saying that Coors resells this scrap at a loss?
Yes.
Can you have a wholesale transaction, buy something for the purpose of selling something at a loss? Is that a wholesale transaction?
Not if you're going to stay in business very long. And that's why it is not one of their purposes when they buy the aluminum to recycle it. Their only purpose really is to make cans. And it's just a fact of the technology and the way that the business works and the manufacturing process works that it's 20% inefficient. But still, they don't do it because they want to recycle it. If they could do it without having any scrap, they would, because this is 10% off their bottom line. You know, it's nice that they recycle, and recycling is you know, the way of the future and the way of the present. But the mere fact that they resell it does not change the fact that when they buy it for the sole purpose of making cans.
Well, is it really 10% off the bottom line if they sell the tops and the tabs for a profit?
Well, yeah, but the profit is reduced by the loss that they incur in the recycling process.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that let's say they buy the coil of aluminum for a dollar, and they sell the cans at a profit of 15 cents, and they lose 10 cents on the scrap. They still made $5, so their bottom line from this process is still okay, right?
Well, they'd rather make 15 cents.
Well, I understand that, but still, if that's the case, why doesn't that make it wholesale? Because they are still making money off of the original purchase.
Well, first of all, because it is not resold in an unused and unaltered condition. All of the scrap goes through the manufacturing process and is used in the manufacturing process to set the procedures in place. When the stamping takes place in a box that has straight lines. It's either, I don't know whether it's a square or a rectangle. I didn't want to get that close to it to find out. But I can tell you that it's box. And they stamp, and then they cut up the stuff, and then it's sucked up in the vacuums and ends up in these little bricks.
Do you have any case or any kind of analysis that helps us figure out whether something is unaltered or altered or used or unused condition? Because, you know, the other side of the argument is, gee, the nature of the substance hasn't changed. It's still the same aluminum.
Well, if you look at the case law that talks about that, it has to be, and if you look at the Golden Code, the exemption from sales tax language, which is the processing clause, the sales tax shall not apply to the following: tangible personal property, to a person engaged in the business of manufacturing, compounding for sale, profit, or use, any article, substance, or commodity, subsection B, which tangible personal property becomes by the manufacturing or compounding process a necessary and recognizable ingredient, component, and constituent part of the finished product. This scrap does not become a part of a finished product. And
does that help me with the unaltered condition or unused condition, or is that shifting over to a different argument?
Well, no, it is altered, because as it comes in, it's part of a coil. As it comes out, it's a little chip of aluminum. That's an alteration. And we haven't talked about the Aramark case and the presumptions that go in favor of the city in this case. The Aramark and Catholic Health Initiatives and Noble Energy stand for the proposition that, in general, as you know, when in construing a tax code, the presumptions favor the taxpayer unless you're talking about an exemption. The wholesale determination is an exemption. And when you're looking at an exemption, all of the presumptions and inferences are turned on their head, and in fact, the city gets the virtue of any doubt that you may have about whether it's wholesale or not. And I would suggest that that trumps any concern about whether or not this is wholesale or retail. I would submit that it's clear that it is retail, but in case of any doubt, the presumptions favor the city. Ties go to the city, basically, based on the applicable case law from the Supreme Court.
Mr. Merrigan, I presume you want to save some time for rebuttal, but let me just ask you, could you address quickly the, we all know use tax and sales tax complement each other.
Yes.
When this transaction happens, the scrap gets sold, you all collect tax on that, I assume.
No, that's what we're here to talk about.
The other side has to pay tax. The person who buys the scrap has to pay tax on that sales tax, right?
No, they don't, unless we tax it here. It is not taxed. That scrap will never be taxed.
Why is that not a retail sale? I'm confused.
It's not. It's not a tax. It's not a retail sale. It is, in fact, a sale of a commodity.
So then when the reseller uses it, it gets a use tax, the ultimate buyer uses it, it'll get taxed.
Yes, it'll be melted down, combined with other scrap, and maybe come back as a softball bat, at which time it'll be taxed. But that's, if it's not taxed by the City of Golden, as we're asking you to rule here, it will not be taxed.
Well, it will be sometime when it ultimately gets used.
Well, but it's a discrete transaction. That is, we're talking about the taxation of the aluminum as a coil. The fact that it may be reincarnated, if you will, as a softball bat and someday be retaxed, or someday be taxed, does not imply that there is multiple taxation. There's still only one taxable event here, and that is the sale of the aluminum coil, and that is all the city seeks to tax. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Neil Pomerantz, bar number 24741, on behalf of the taxpayers, whom I will refer to as Miller Coors. I'd like to begin by addressing the taxability question and then move to the interest issue raised by our cross appeal. This matter asks the court to interpret two exemption provisions that are designed to avoid the multiplication of taxes on raw materials and other goods before they reach the end consumer. The first is the general wholesale exemption, which applies to goods that are purchased and then resold before any meaningful use of the goods takes place. And the second is the so-called processing clause exemption, which exempts materials that will become components of a compounded or manufactured product or commodity. The district court properly found that the subject aluminum qualified for the general wholesale exemption, and so it didn't reach the question of whether the processing clause also barred this assessment. MillerCoors contends that both exemptions apply and compel a ruling in its favor. I'll begin with the general wholesale exemption. The Golden Code tells us simply that wholesale sales are sales for resale.
Counsel, let me ask you, let me cut right to the chase. And Hirschfeld, I'm interested in this unaltered condition and unused condition. Why don't you consider it an altered condition? It doesn't look like the same thing that came into your shop when you first started cutting it up.
Well, for a couple reasons. First of all, the case law tells us that a single purchase is not an indivisible unit, that you can break apart a single purchase into two different components. And so that's what's happening here. 80% of this aluminum is finding its way into the aluminum cans, and 20% ultimately is recycled. It's sold as aluminum briquettes. So the question is, you look at that 20% and you ask, was that in unaltered and basically unused form?
Are you arguing both sides here? You know, there's only one event, so therefore you can only look at it one way, and yet you can have two different components taxed differently?
No. The two different components are analyzed separately for purposes of taxation and for purposes of these exemptions. The 20% that's at issue here was unaltered. It remained in place on the coils after the stamping process. The only change in its form happened in connection with preparing it for resale. Importantly, the case law tells us that unaltered isn't really applied literally. The cases tell us, Hirschfeld tells us, that a minor use of an item does not defeat wholesale status. The CF&I Steel case talks about a brief utilization, and there are a number of cases in which there was some alteration of the material before the ultimate resale took place. Examples include Conoco, where you had crude oil coming in, and the amount of crude oil that was at issue was reconstituted. Its form was changed into a waste oil. In that case, the court didn't say, well, you can't qualify for the wholesale exemption because it changed. It looked to what happened next. Was there an actual act of consumption of the material? Another good example is the CF&I Steel case. There was a quantity of steel that came in, a certain portion of which was used to create molds that were then used in the manufacturing process. There was clearly an alteration of that material. It was later melted back down, and it was put back into the production process. And the court still held there that that was a resale. So the courts have not applied the unaltered and basically unused as an absolute standard, that there can't be any alteration at all. The question is, was there a meaningful alteration? And was there an actual act of consumption? There was no act of consumption that takes place here. And I think it's also very important to note here that the only change in the form of the aluminum that's at issue here was for the purpose of preparing it for resale. That's all we did. We weren't altering its form in order to gain some advantageous use out of it. We simply changed its form in order to put it into briquettes so it would be more efficiently resold. I think the question from one of the judges was, what happens if it had just sort of come out and been resold without being compressed into the briquettes? There should be no difference in the outcome here.
And is it fair to say that this aluminum that is eventually sold as scrap is never incorporated into a product that MillerCoors sells, and it's never, and its fundamental chemical composition isn't altered? The difference is simply the rearrangement of the physical aluminum so that it's more efficient for you to resell it.
That's absolutely true. It's aluminum atoms coming in, it's aluminum atoms going out. There's no addition or subtraction from that. I think it's also important to note, in response to some of the questioning that took place with opposing counsel, that I lost my train of thought for a second.
Counsel, can I ask you the same question I ask opposing counsel? Can you have a wholesale event if you intend to resell something at a loss?
Absolutely. It happens all the time. It happens with loss leaders. Companies sell one product so that they can sell another one at a higher price. It happens in cases simply because they can't earn a profit from an item that they have in inventory. They may have to sell it at a loss. Overstocked items, for example. Moreover, even within these exemption statutes, it tells us that you don't have to resell the item for a profit. The processing clause exemption, for example, begins by saying that it applies to sales of tangible personal property to a person engaged in the business of manufacturing, compounding, for sale, profit, or use. So if you merely sell it, that's enough. You don't have to sell it at a profit.
The processing clause.
That's the processing
clause. That's right, but not the wholesale clause. Doesn't say anything about profit.
The code doesn't speak to it one way or another, but I will say again that it just happens all the time. If I buy 10 widgets for $10 each and I can't sell them on the open market for $10 or $12 at a profit, I may have to sell them at $8. There's no question that that's treated as a wholesale sale.
That's true, but when you initially buy them, don't you intend to sell them at a profit?
Sure.
Don't you intend to sell them at a profit? And Coors does not intend to sell them at a profit.
Well, I don't think the notion of intent is found in the statutes. In other words, you don't even have to buy something with the intent to sell it at a profit.
I understand it's not in the statutes. I'm just trying to get a feel for wholesale events.
And it does happen in the real world that companies buy items at wholesale with the understanding that they will sell it at a loss. Cell phones, for example. You know, Verizon buys a certain quantity of cell phones from Apple. They sell them at a subsidized price. If you just look at that cell phone, it's being sold at a loss. Why do they do it? Because there's a sound business reason for doing so. But I do want to emphasize...
Well, the sound business reason is that they're going to make money through another thing, which is the plan that they sell along with the phone, right?
They hope so, but it doesn't always happen that way. There's absolutely no requirement under the law in order to qualify for the wholesale exemption, that you resell the item at a profit.
Or that you acquire it with the intent to sell it at a profit.
Or that you acquire it with the intent.
Okay.
Right. I mean, the cases tell us just the opposite. They tell us you look to what actually happened. They say, did you engage in a resale of that item? Did you take it and resell it to another? That's all it requires. Well, it doesn't look to price.
When would that occur, Mr. Pomerantz? I mean, I suppose you can take, this to the theater of the absurd. You take a product and maybe you use it, whatever you do with it, and then 12 years later you resell it. I mean, can you then look back and that seems and say, well, obviously it was a wholesale transaction because a decade later we sold it. I'm struggling with whether you really could say you don't look at intent at all at the initial stage of the transaction, because where's the line? I mean, when do you decide whether it was a wholesale transaction?
Well, let me start by saying that there is an intent at the start here, when this aluminum is purchased, that the 20% that we're talking about is going to be resold. That absolutely is the intent. They know exactly what percentage to the third decimal is going to be resold.
Right. But you said that the intent is not the dispositive factor, so I guess I'm trying to figure out what is the dispositive issue. It strikes me it can't just be that at some point you resell it and voila, it's a wholesale transaction, but maybe that's your position. I'm just concerned with how broad that would be.
Our position is that you look to the ultimate facts. You look to the actual disposition. So you say, what actually happened to it? And if it was resold, then you go back and you look at the original purchase and you say that was in fact, as measured by subsequent events, as the cases tell us, that was in fact a wholesale purchase, a purchase for resale.
Is there a case that you can cite to me on that? I know there are some cases where at the beginning it wasn't clear if it was going to be a retail or wholesale transaction. I suppose you can say that about IBM. It's not clear at the beginning whether they're going to keep those components or not for their own use. So I understand at the beginning there's a question. Here there apparently is no question. So I guess what's the best case that supports your position that if there's a resale at any point, it's a wholesale transaction?
Both IBM and Conoco stand for that proposition. They say you look to the actual events that happened. Even Hirschfeld, the case that the city relies upon so heavily, tells us that in applying the primary purpose test, it says it does require inquiry into the actual conduct of a purchaser subsequent to a disputed purchase to ascertain by objective means the primary purpose of the transaction.
Sure, but in Hirschfeld and Martin Marietta, I mean, the facts were the contract said, and Hirschfeld was pre-press materials, they're going to give those to the customers. I mean, that would seem inconsistent with the intent, because the taxpayer in Hirschfeld always knew those pre-press materials are going to be given to the customer and would have worked in the price and, I would assume, in the transaction.
Right, but the court said that the fact that they were going to transfer it to the customer didn't matter at the end of the day.
It
was still a retail purchase because they were using those items, the court says, extensively to manufacture goods for another. Here that's not the case. We're not talking about a raw material input that comes in that's being used by MillerCoors to manufacture other goods. This is, to the contrary, the raw materials from which goods are being made. This is just the leftover.
All right, so we look, if I'm understanding, and correct me, we look at really both. What use Coors was making of this, of the scrap, which is essentially none, and the fact that they resold it. It's not just the resale alone, it's that they didn't even use it.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. I mean, you have to say it wasn't, in fact, resold. But not every resale marks the initial purchase of a wholesale purchase. You have to look to whether there was a taxable intervening event.
That's
there
what
was
I'm
struggling.
Okay.
And you can look at any number of cases, for example, that show that this intervening event was not a taxable event. For example, the Adolf Coors case that we cited, where Adolf Coors, it took these kegs that were coming in, it repaired them, it washed them, it sterilized them before sending them out again. The court said, well, that wasn't an intervening taxable event. The Conoco case, where again there was an actual conversion of this raw material that came in, this crude oil, into a waste gas, that was not considered an intervening taxable event. That only became taxable because ultimately Conoco consumed, they burned that waste oil to produce heat. The CF&I case was obviously an alteration, a change, some kind of use of the steel before it was ultimately resold. But they said, still, on the whole, this was not a sufficient taxable event to defeat the original wholesale status. By comparison to those cases, we have a far lower level of use here. And I'll emphasize in that regard that the courts have looked not only to the level of use, in which, by comparison to the cases, we have a much lower level of use, but they've looked at the quality of the use. Conoco tells us that simply running a raw material through a manufacturing process is not a taxable event. That's what we've got going on here. And again, at a much lower level than happened in Conoco. But running a raw material through a manufacturing operation is not taxable in and of itself. It only becomes taxable if there's an act of consumption later. And that's what all of these statutes are intended to produce. They're intended to apply tax when there's a final consumption of a product or a good. So when Mr. American tells you that, well, the commodity here isn't taxed going out, it isn't taxed going out for a very good reason, because it's going to be purchased, because that's another wholesale transaction. And it may work its way through a number of wholesale transactions until it finds its way into a final good that's going to be sold to an end consumer. At that point, tax is properly applied. If we apply tax here to this unused commodity, it's going to be that cost is going to be taxed twice and possibly more before it reaches the end product. And that's what fundamentally the tax law is intended to avoid. May I move just real briefly to the interest issue that's raised by our cross appeal? We believe the statutory language here is unambiguous. It tells us that when a taxpayer deposits funds under protest with a local government and ultimately prevails in the litigation, those funds are returned with interest at the conclusion of the action. We think that language is absolutely clear. If those words by themselves are not abundantly clear, any doubt is removed by the clause that immediately follows that phrase at the conclusion of the action. The words that follow are, after appeal to the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, or after the time for such appeal has expired. That's when the funds are returned with interest by the local government. The district court held that, well, the statute doesn't preclude an earlier return of the funds. We think it does. It uses the word shall, that's a mandate. The funds can't be returned at the conclusion of the action if they're returned sometime earlier. Second, the legislature knows how to permit an earlier return of funds and stop the accrual of interest when it wants to. There are other post-judgment interest statutes that we've cited in our papers, section 5-12-106, and another one, which specifically say that interest accrues until satisfaction of the judgment. That kind of language accommodates the idea of a return of the funds prior to the conclusion of the action. The legislature didn't say that here. They meant something different. I believe my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Briefly on the interest issue, we think the trial court got that right. We don't read the statute to say that just because the taxpayer elects to provide, to make a deposit of the full amount of the assessment at the initiation of the litigation, that the city is obliged to hold it whilst interest accrues against it at the rate of 6%. During the time that this matter was pending before the trial court, the interest that accrued at that rate was over $265,000. The city had no source for that money other than to take it from the funds given to it by other taxpayers. And that simply is not fair. And all the statute says is that if the city ultimately loses the appeal, they have to give the money back. Well, certainly that's true, and the city understands that. But the city is not precluded from trying to make a determination to give it back. Otherwise, it faces the possibility, like I said, if an appeal goes on for years and it ultimately loses, could be millions of dollars in accrued interest. And in the today's interest environment, that is simply not fair and not good policy.
Thank you, Council. Your time has expired.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted, and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both very much.